Now, Secretary Vilsack's ideas don't necessarily sit well with everyone in the business of tracking the farming industry. Sally James does that for a living. She's an agricultural trade policy analyst with the Libertarian Cato Institute here in Washington, and she's in the studio with me. Sally James, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
How economically feasible is it for the vast majority of Americans to buy and eat local foods?
Not very. I think it's going to be very difficult not only to get people within that local, quote-unquote, distance of a farmer's market, but to have enough of a farm production agriculture to feed 300 million people.
I mean, as we heard in our conversation with Secretary Vilsack, right now about 75% of the produce and meat we consume in this country is made by 4%, less than 4% of farmers in America. Wouldn't this plan that the Agriculture Department is now promoting put an end to that monopoly?
Maybe, although I think one of the reasons we get those sorts of outcomes in agriculture is the subsidy system, which, because it's partly based on paying growers per unit of production, encourages kind of that commercial large-scale farming. It may well be that if we did away with production subsidies, that we may see a different breakout of production patterns in America. But certainly that suggests that for efficiency reasons, agriculture depends on economies of scale.
Farmers' markets in this country have expanded over the past year by some 13%. The Agriculture Department argues that it's because of the setup and marketing that they have helped to provide that we have seen that rise. What's wrong with the government sort of getting involved in promoting things like farmers markets where people would have access to fresh, locally grown produce?
You throw enough money at something, of course it's going to thrive. So I'm not surprised that, you know, it's not front page news that the Agriculture Department invests a lot of money in promoting farmers markets. We see more farmers markets. That, to me, is a pretty much a no-brainer. What I'm suggesting is it's not the best use of money. There is absolutely very little wrong with encouraging people to eat healthily. But what the problem is here is poor people having access to fresh fruit and vegetables.
So how do you change that?
You allow Walmart to come in to urban areas and provide cheap fresh produce to people. A lot of the same people who are advocating farmers markets for health reasons also oppose Walmart going into urban areas, the city of Chicago, Los Angeles, some problems in Washington, D.C. with Walmart coming in. But the reality is they have a very good distribution network. They can get fresh produce into rural and ex-urban areas very well. And I'm sure they'd love to provide produce to poor people, but often activists prevent that from happening as well.
Sally James is a trade policy analyst with the Cato Institute. She joined me here in the studio. Sally James, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Do you think Americans would be willing to pay more for locally produced food? Get in on the conversation by commenting at npr.org.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Writer Michael Pollan famously advises, eat food, not too much, mostly plants, and don't buy foods you've seen advertised on TV. And that's just the kernel of his ideas about the American food industry and American agriculture in his enormously popular books, including his latest, In Defense of Food. Last month, the University of Wisconsin-Madison gave that book to all incoming freshmen and urged professors to discuss it in class, which, as you might suspect, set off a Donnybrook in a heavily agricultural state. A lot of farmers challenge Pollan's work as a direct attack on them and how they work. Some ideas of his may be appealing, they say, but unrealistic. Others, just ill-informed. Today we'll talk with Michael Pollan and with two working farmers who deal every day with the practices that he criticizes. Later in the program, Farhad Manju of Slate on the international fishing ring broken up by the FBI and his practical ideas on how to protect our terrible passwords. But first, the omnivores debate, and we'd like to hear from farmers today. If you're familiar with Pollan's critique, is it accurate? Are his proposed solutions practical? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And Michael Pollan joins us now from the studios on the campus at the University of California at Berkeley. And nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Neil. Good to be back.
And remind us, if you would, the critique of American farmers.
How much time do you have?
Well, a capsule if you could.
Let me start, though, by alluding to something you said in your setup, because I don't think it was true. You said I was critical of American farmers. Now, some farmers have taken what I say that way. But in fact, I kind of defy anyone to find things I've actually written that are critical of farmers. I am critical of various practices, and I'm very critical of a system, a set of incentives that really forces farmers to plant monocultures and to consolidate and get bigger, and leaves them with very few choices in the way of either markets to sell their products or ways to grow them. And that's very different than saying you're critical of farmers. It really is a system that I'm critical of. And it's a system that's been designed by other people and is the result of the kind of farm policies we have in our country.
So farmers themselves,
that's an important distinction.
Farmers themselves have few choices.
Well, very often they do. If you're growing corn and soybeans in the Midwest, you know, there's one buyer of your products. That's the grain elevator in town. If you want to, as farmers have told me, if you want to try to do something else, if you want to grow some broccoli or some tomatoes, you run into all sorts of problems. The first is that under the farm policies, you lose your subsidies as soon as you get out of corn and bean land. The second is, who's going to buy your food? So there are many farmers who are interested in changing what they're doing, who see that growing lots of corn and soy doesn't really work that well for them either. I mean, that farm income has been falling. We had a spike last year. And that this system doesn't really serve their interests either. But it's important to understand that there is a counteroffensive underway right now from the agribusiness lobby, and that is trying to depict this critique. And it's not just my critique. It's the critique in Food Inc. and Eric Schlosser's work and a whole lot of other people as an attack on farmers. And that is the agribusiness hiding behind farmers, as far as I can tell.
How can you – well, you've explained that the people are forced into this. Some of these farmers – and why don't we bring a farmer on to speak for himself, all right? Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Blake Hurst is a farmer in northwest Missouri with six other family members. He grows corn and soybeans on 4,500 acres there. His family also raised cattle for many years. They don't do that anymore, though. He recently wrote an article for the Journal of the American Enterprise Institute called The Omnivore's Delusion Against the Agri-Intellectuals, and among them, Michael Pollan. And he joins us from the studios of NET Radio in Lincoln, Nebraska. And it's good to have you on the program. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And do you have choices in what you do and how you do it?
Well, certainly I do. The road goes right by my house. I can get on it and leave at any time. I can put different products on it and sell them at any time. I choose to grow corn and soybeans because I challenge the monoculture. Corn's grass. Soybeans are a legume. We rotate them year after year. That allows us to not use... You know, we use absolutely no insecticides because different insects attack different crops. So first off, I believe I'm in a monoculture. My friends in southern Missouri grow rice, wheat, cotton, corn, and soybeans. So they have lots of variety in the things they grow. But I'm not trapped at all. This is a free society. I choose to do what I'm doing. I'm proud to be doing it, and I enjoy it.
And when you read Michael Pollan's work, I read your article, and you said he's depicting you and other farmers as being, well, either dupes of commercial interests or, well, not so bright.
Well, yeah. I mean, he says the agribusiness is hiding behind me. Like when I wrote the article, Monsanto was in the room with me. I mean, you know, my wife helped me sound out some of the big words, but other than that, I did it all on my own, and I'm not a tool of anybody.
And the other farmers that you know and other people in your district, they're doing the things that they are doing, presumably, because that's the best way to make a living?
Yeah, yeah. And farming is a competitive industry, and whether I'm raising broccoli or corn or soybeans, the profits that come back to me will always be the level of profit that the marginal last farmer is willing to accept. So it tends to be a competitive business. Yes, I wish I received more for my grain. Yes, I wish my income was higher. But I enjoy what I do, and clearly if my income was not high enough, I'd get another job.
Michael Pollan, as you look at the statements by Mr. Hurst and others, I don't think he's part of a he did write for a conservative journal, but is he part of this concerted attack you're talking about?
Oh, I don't know that. I can't say whether Blake is writing as an individual for himself or is part of something larger than that. Obviously, I don't question his motives in writing that piece at all. I'm just saying that what's going on around the country right now and the efforts to silence my speeches on college campuses where there are agribusiness interests involved, which is happening, you know. As you said, in Madison, there was a lot of protest, and in
That was after handing out the book to every student, every freshman is hardly
muzzling you. The Farm Bureau in Wisconsin had a big problem and it was very interesting what happened there. They bussed in several hundred farmers, all wearing green T-shirts that said "In Defense of Farmers," and they were expecting to hear a very different Michael Pollan, I think, than they actually heard. Because when they left, they were surprised that what I said didn't conform to what the Farm Bureau was telling them I said, which is to say I was talking about how to build new agricultural markets so that they could diversify. I was talking about figuring out ways to get more of the consumer's food dollar into their pockets. Right now, 90% of the consumer's food dollar goes to middlemen, processors, marketers. And that in the kinds of alternative agriculture that we're beginning to talk about in this country, there are great opportunities for farmers. And I think a lot of farmers, whether they take those opportunities or not, the fact that there are now these new markets, whether it's for organic or pasture-raised livestock or, farmers market food or all these other kinds of things, these are great opportunities for farmers who had less choices in the past. And when the farmers left that hall, they were kind of surprised. And I talked to some ag journalists who said, yeah, we were on the bus with them going back. And they said they really didn't find as much to disagree with in what you said than they expected. And so I think that there is something of a caricature being drawn here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. You know, the other thing I want to say is that I really welcome this debate that's getting started. You know, it is long overdue. And Blake is definitely part of that. And he wrote a really cogent, powerful contribution to that debate, and he raised some really good critiques of alternative agriculture, which is to say, do we have enough farmers to do it? Will it be productive enough? Will we be able to make food? Will we be able to change without raising the price of food? These are really key questions for the alternative food movement, and he honed right in on them. And there are no easy answers. But having this political debate about where farming and food are going in this country is exactly what we need, and I'm delighted to see it being joined.
Blake Hurst, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I want to, you know, I think that reading a lot of the comments and stuff on the web about my article, it's clear I did not do one thing very well, and that is, as the old joke goes, some of my best friends are organic farmers.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I am absolutely let 1,000 flowers bloom. We grow flowers on our farm. I actually sell them at the farm. I sell directly to the consumer. I think it's wonderful. There's new markets and new kinds of food being raised. And I it's fun for us to leave the farm and go to a restaurant where someone's cooking something different than we might receive at home. But the point I would make is that there are environmental costs to turning our back on technology. I guess that was the point of my article. In other words, we farm no-till farming, which we were only able to do because of chemicals or because of pesticides that we use. And that cuts our erosion probably down to 20% of what it was 30 years ago when I began farming. Now, we may choose to move away from technology, and the consumer is going to make that decision in the final analysis. But she needs to know, the consumer needs to know that there's environmental costs to farming as the critics of farming would have us to do.
Well, I guess I would just say to that is, I assume when you talk about no-till farming, are you talking about using Roundup ready crops?
Yeah, we do, although you can do it without them. But yeah, we use Roundup ready beans, not corn, but beans.
And it is absolutely true that Roundup ready soy has helped with erosion in the Middle West. There was a huge problem with soil just disappearing from our farms. But it's very important that even when you point to an achievement, and that is, in my view, the one achievement of Roundup Ready soy, that you take a clear-eyed view of the costs of these technologies, because there really are trade-offs. The high productivity of American agriculture has had costs, environmental costs, pollution costs, the amount of nitrogen that washes off of fields that ends up in the Mississippi and creates a dead zone in the Gulf that's now the size of Massachusetts. So, you know, there are achievements and there are costs.
We're going to have to resume after a short break. The music means we're coming up on a post. So, gentlemen, stay with us. Michael Pollan, the author of, most recently, In Defense of Food, and Blake Hurst, who farms corn and soybeans on 4,500 acres with six other members of his family in northwest Missouri. Both of you stay with us, please. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Most of us can agree that we should eat healthier, lots of vegetables and fresh produce, fewer processed foods. The debate is in the details, where we get our food, who produces it, and how. Is it practical to eat only fresh local foods grown organically? We'd like to hear from farmers today. Are these proposed solutions practical for you? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Our guests are Michael Pollan, a young reader's edition of The Omnivore's Dilemma, will be published next week. And Blake Hurst farms 4,500 acres with his family in northwest Missouri. He wrote the opinion piece, The Omnivore's Delusion, Against the Agri-Intellectuals for the July issue of the Journal of the American Enterprise Institute. Let's get a caller on the line. And Adam is calling us from Rodelia in Kentucky. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I'm a farmer. This is my third year. I'm actually considered a young farmer, even though I'm 29, on a beef cattle farm that's been in the family for quite a while, and I just started diversifying into vegetables and mushrooms as well as pastured poultry, and we're now grass finishing our beef, all for direct marketing and sale through CSA and farmers markets.
I'm sorry, what's the CSA?
The CSA is a program where members pay their paid up front for a season of vegetables where they get a delivery each week, where I raise over 40 different vegetables.
And, so that sounds very local then.
It is. It's the idea is that it really connects the customer, the consumer, to their food because they understand what's in season and when it's available. And so my comment is really just about the differences that's being made between organic and conventional farming is that organic has a much higher cost and that it's not as productive necessarily. And I just kind of have a definitely don't believe that that's true with animal agriculture because I've seen with our finishing our animals on grass that we have a much lower input, and that's through fossil fuels and making hay. If we're able to finish our animals on pasture that we keep the animals on year round, and I think that's true with the chickens as well. The chickens are able to consume 25 to 30% of their needs, their nutritional needs out of the grass, clover, and insects that they find on the pasture. So that, again, brings our feed costs down. And I think that's kind of a myth that organic agriculture is not really productive or efficient because it actually uses natural systems and biological systems to enhance its productivity. And that's not taken into account at all in our conventional view of agriculture.
Adam, when we go to the store, if they sell organic produce or organically raised meats, as you do, they're always more expensive.
Well, yeah, they're not subsidized by the federal government as most of the food, and also the processors and the grain buyers and all these things are subsidized by our taxpayer money, and that's not the case with organic food. It's actually more in line with the true cost of food is going to be.
The true cost, so we're not paying enough, in other words.
Yeah, I mean, I'm taking a lot of what Michael said already, you know, that this is, we don't have any idea what food actually costs in terms of not just labor, but actual inputs and money, and that's well off base with what the rest of the world actually understands how their food is made and what it actually takes. We're far from that.
Let me ask Blake Hurst about the role of subsidies in the economics of your farm.
We accept subsidies. We're involved in farm programs. I would point out for the last several years they have played a very small part in our income, play almost no part in the decisions we make. Last year, my total direct farm payments were about 3% of my gross sales. I'm not sure that they changed the price of grain very much, that they affected the decisions I made. Well, I'm positive they didn't affect the decisions I made on the farm. I would point out that everyone talks about local sales and local farming, and we need to remember that not all of us are able to have sell directly to the consumer. Within a 30-mile radius of my farm, there's probably only 6,000 people. It's almost impossible for me to have the kind of relationship with the consumer that the caller is talking about. So that's a very good thing for people who live near urban areas, and I commend them for it. But for those of us that live where I do, what I raise is going to have to get on a truck and go to the city. It's just almost impossible for it to be consumed in any other way.
Michael Pollan, are the subsidies a big part of the conversation?
Yeah, subsidies are a big part of the conversation. In Blake's case, the fact that he received so little last year probably reflects the fact that grain prices were at record levels. If you go to Iowa in an average year, though, farm income is about 40% government payments. So it is for most commodity farmers in the Middle West a big part of the equation, and I think it does limit their freedom of operation. And whether that is driving down the cost of grain is a very complicated question. I mean, a lot of people argue that even if you got rid of them, grain prices would still be low and keep falling because farmers have a lot of incentives to overproduce.
Okay. Well, in Mr. Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, he seems to be lamenting the changes in farm policy that happened in the late 80s and early 90s. In other words, before then, the government literally set the price. Now the market clears. The government does not set a floor under the cost of the cost. So I think Mr. Pollan is correct. I mean, I think, and most farmers would disagree with me, but I think he is correct. I think that farm subsidies, the way they are now, probably do make the price of grain lower than it would be without them. Less variable. Our incomes are less variable. And yes, indeed, in low price years, a larger part of our income comes from farm subsidies. But I think he's right about that. I have no disagreement. I don't think that we want to go back to where we were in the 1970s. There was huge amounts of problems caused by those programs as well.
Well, that's true. But, we're going to scare people off by talking about farm subsidies.
We are. Mostly me.
All right, Neil, move on.
All right. I wanted to thank Adam for his phone call and introduce another farmer on the program. Troy Rausch farms corn and soybeans on 6,000 acres in central Indiana. Also vice president of the American Corn Growers Association. He joins us from the studios of member station WFYI in Indianapolis. And we know you've gone to some effort to be with us today. We appreciate it.
Hi, Neil. Thanks.
And I know you've been listening to the conversation as well. Are the kinds of things we're talking about practical to kinds of things Michael Pollan's talking about practical for farmers to do?
Well, practical in what sense? The big question, and both Michael and Neil alluded to this.
Blake, I'm not the farmer.
I'm sorry. You're Neil.
I was born with a black thumb. I grow nothing.
Blake alluded to this, is whether or not we can, in fact, feed an ever-growing population in a post-peak oil world. And that perhaps is the big question.
And how does that impact how you farm on your farm?
We've, in the last couple of years, become very cognizant of energy cost because it drives a lot of our input cost, namely fertilizer. And, we manage that as best we can. But as we look at this going forward, we're starting to ask questions. What's going to happen when oil returns to $100, $150 a barrel? How are we going to manage that on our farm and be profitable?
And the questions are hard to answer, aren't they?
No, they're very difficult to answer. Therefore, that's what I find so intriguing about Michael's book is this discussion of cover crops and widening out our rotations and utilizing animal manures and such to try to get away from the more industrial type of farming that we now do.
But are you planting half your ground to legumes every year and raising corn the next year?
I'm experimenting. I'm learning. Working with a lot of cover crops. It's a difficult process, and it's a learning
because
process.
That restores nitrogen to the soil and reduces the amount of fertilizer you'd have to use the following year.
Yeah, but the problem is that our growing season does not allow us to grow a cover crop from the time one year is harvested till we plant the next year. So we have to grow the cover crop so we don't grow corn for a year, grow cover crop, and then come back with corn, which is the way, of course, my grandfather farmed in the 30s. And he would take hay off of the cover crop to feed his cattle. And the problem is that doesn't provide as much nitrogen as my crop needs, and I lose income for a year. So I'm using twice as much labor and twice as much water and twice as much land to raise the same amount of corn. And so there's environmental cost to all, and plus, of course, I'm tilling the ground four or five times both years, where in the system I use now, I'm not tilling it at all. So there's erosion costs, there's land costs, there's water costs, and there's labor costs. Hmm. The 3% of the United States nitrogen, or 3% of our energy goes into making nitrogen for crops. So it's a very small part of our energy use.
Now let's get Josie on the line. Josie's calling us from Boise.
Yes, hi. I want to say how honored I am to be on this show.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you to say.
I am an organic farmer in Boise, Idaho. I'm lucky enough to be a urban farmer. My husband and I farm 33 acres within the city limits, and this year we're expanding to a 60-acre model so that we can put it into REFs and paddocks. Systems, just like we've read in the Omnivore's Dilemma. And mm-hmm. So it's such an honor for us to have people like Michael Pollan writing books about exactly how we farm.
And as you say, this is a very small farm and an urban farm. And are the principles that he endorses easier for you because of that?
I think it's easy because I am 6 miles away from downtown Boise. So I don't have to use any days to truck my food into the city. Also, I'm very accessible to the community, so I can teach classes and have dinners. I can have greenhouse sales, which really help. But my husband and I have tried to run our whole farm in the black with no loans. And right before the show came on, we were having a heated discussion about a new barn. And I don't think we can afford the whole barn this year. And he doesn't think that we should just build half a barn. Huh. And so I said, you know, can we just put the posts where maybe it's going to be built? And I think farmers, no matter what type of crop they're growing, commodity, organic, diverse, CSA, it's a tough row to hoe. There's not much money in farming, no matter how you're growing or what you're growing.
I think you can get universal agreement on that. I just have to ask one quick question, Josie. Do you make, is this your principal source of income?
This is our principal source of income. We're very lucky to have this be our principal source of income. This is our seventh year. We run a CSA farm with other different markets. We grow about 120 types of vegetables, herbs, fruits, flowers, and pastured poultry that we run then through our cover crop. And we're figuring it out without taking out loans. And it feels really good to not have debt like I know a lot of my large farming friends have.
Well, Josie, thanks very much for the call. Good luck to you, and I hope you get the whole barn built.
I hope so, too. Thanks so much.
Neil, could I jump in?
I just want to say one thing, that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, no, I think it's very interesting to hear this conversation and listen to Blake talk about the challenges of extending his rotations and the experiments that I know Troy is doing on his farm. The fact is, that's what we need, is this spirit of innovation. And we need to build a safety net under farmers so they can do it. What Troy said is exactly right. We are going to need to be able to learn how to farm without so much fossil fuel. We're going to have to learn how to use the sun again. It doesn't mean turning back the clock. It means coming up with a broader definition of technology. A really ingenious rotation for the Midwest represents exactly the kind of technology we need. It's just as sophisticated as a Roundup Ready seed. And, you know, if you go to Argentina, they have a very interesting rotation. They do an 8-year rotation. They'll do 5 years of cattle on grass. They'll rotate them around their pastures, and then they'll do 3 years of grain. And they find if they do that, there's so much fertility in the soil, they don't need to use any nitrogen for 3 years of grain. They also don't need any herbicides. You know, that means putting animals back on farms. That's a radical change from where we are. But this is the kind of work that you know, ingenious farmers like Blake and Troy and the woman who just called will be figuring out, and hopefully they'll get a little help from the agricultural schools.
Go ahead, Blake.
Well, I mean, the nitrogen problem is a problem. I mean, that is the problem. That is the question. I mean, where does the nitrogen come from? Those cows don't produce nitrogen out of the air. The only nitrogen they can leave on the ground is what they take from their diet. And so how can they grow 3 years of corn without adding nitrogen? Well, either there's been – I don't know. Are they growing enough legumes in their rotation to get nitrogen for 3 years? I don't know. I mean, it's not going to work on my farm. I'm not sure of that because we tried it.
But I did want to ask if that future that Troy was talking about where oil goes to $100, $150 a gallon again, a barrel, excuse me, again, if that is indeed our future, and some people believe it is, what's that going to do to your costs?
Well, it's going to make them higher, which means that food costs are going to have to go up. But Mr. Pollan in his book quotes another book about nitrogen and says 40% of the world people that are alive today in the world are there because of the ability to synthesize nitrogen from the air using energy. We have to have the nitrogen. We can't get it any other way if we're going to feed the population we have today or the 50% increase in population that we're looking at over the next 50 years. That's the only, I mean, there is no other answer. And we're rich in America, and we can experiment, and we may choose to do things differently. But most of the world is going to have commercial nitrogen in order to feed their population.
Hmm. Well, I think it is. Go ahead, Troy.
Just got a minute left, so go ahead.
Sure. I think we've got to step back and take a look at this nitrogen question. And the first question we perhaps should ask is, do we as American farmers need to be producing 13 billion bushels of corn? We're feeding corn to cattle. That's not necessarily the prudent thing to be doing. What Michael proposes is we put these cattle back on the pastures.
And Michael, we'll give you 30 seconds for the last word.
Well, you know, nitrogen is the big question, but I would not give up on the idea that we can figure out systems, ecological systems, to feed ourselves. We don't know the answer. We don't know for sure we can feed the world more sustainably, but we sure are going to have to try.
Interesting questions that all of you raise, and it's interesting to me that, indeed, there's a lot of the same questions being asked in different ways by all of you. Thank you all very much for your time today. Michael Pollan is the author of In Defense of Food, and this week a young reader's edition of The Omnivore's Dilemma is going to be published. We thank him for his time. And Blake Hurst, who farms corn and soybean on 4,500 acres with six other members of his family in northwest Missouri, joined us today from NET Radio in Lincoln, Nebraska. And Troy Rausch, who farms corn and soybean on 6,000 acres in central Indiana and is vice president of the American Corn Growers Association at the members studios of member station WFYI in Indianapolis. Both of them went way out of their way to join us today. We thank them so much for their time.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
Hello, how are you doing here in St. Louis? Farm Aid 2009.
As thousands turn out in St. Louis today to hear Willie Nelson, Neil Young, and others performing at the annual Farm Aid concert, we begin the hour with a look at the politics of food. You're hearing the sounds of what locals here in Washington are calling the White House Farmers Market.
It's going to be $3.65, please.
The market is just steps away from the Obama family home and was opened last month by the First Lady, Michelle Obama. Here are some of the things people are buying this time of year.
My name is Arne Vo. I'm shopping for some bison, actually, some bison patties.
Kelly Scarborough, and I'm picking the Autumn Crisp apples. They're for my apple cider wassail.
My name is Arnita Acti, and fresh homegrown food is right up my alley.
It's the first time since Thomas Jefferson was in the White House that fresh produce is being sold in the open air so close to the president's house. It's both an experiment and an undisguised statement. The Obama administration wants Americans to buy more locally grown food. The problem is the way we grow food today means that local produce from small farms is often more expensive than what you find at the grocery store. So farmers markets like this one can be too expensive for lower-income families. But this market and a handful of others around the city and the country are now part of a pilot project backed by the Agriculture Department where food assistance credits are accepted. And those food stamps and WIC coupons are worth twice as much if spent at these participating farmers markets. Mary Ellen Taylor grows lettuce and other vegetables on her farm in Percival, Virginia, and she sells that produce here.
I have seen women walk by with extremely expensive St. John's suits, and then all of these great professionals pour out of these federal office buildings. But along with that woman who has that suit, I also have redeemed more WIC coupons here at this market than any other market I'm in, and I'm in four other Washington markets.
If the local food revolution is quietly underway, it has a surprising new booster. The U.S. Department of Agriculture and its new secretary, Tom Vilsack. Now, the thing you should know about Vilsack is that when he was appointed, he was criticized as a shill for big agribusiness like Monsanto. He was, after all, the governor of Iowa, where support for corn subsidies is practically required to win elective office. But as the agriculture secretary, he's starting to push for small changes in the way food might be grown and distributed in the future. I spoke with Tom Vilsack at his office on Friday.
Secretary Vilsack, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
Is the way most food is grown in the United States today, is that sustainable in your view in the long run?
Well, I think what's interesting, in the last 5 years, we saw 108,000 new farming operations get started with sales of less than $10,000.
So these are small farms.
These are very small farms, but they are a very important component of our agriculture, and there's a real opportunity for us to grow those smaller operations to mid-income-sized operations. And the way to do that is by creating opportunities locally for local production to be consumed locally.
Something like, as you know, 75% of all food grown in the United States is produced by fewer than 4% of farmers. These are large industrial farms. Do you want to put an end to that dominance?
Well, I first of all, with respect, I don't know I would necessarily characterize them all as large industrial farms. I think of farmers in Iowa that I know who have a significant role to play in producing the food and fiber of this country, and they are family operations, and they feel very strongly about generational passing the farm from generation to generation. I frankly believe that we need a diversification of agriculture in our country so that all kinds of agriculture are supported. I don't think you're going to see a transition away from the larger farms that are producing so much of our food and fiber in the short term, but I think over the long term, as we create more local production, local consumption linkages, it will give an opportunity for farms of all size to be more profitable than they have been.
The program that the department is launching, it's called Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food. The idea is to promote locally produced food. Can you talk a little bit about this program?
We think at the USDA that there needs to be a better connection between people and their food. That people have to understand more about where their food comes from.
Why should they understand?
Well,
that?
So that they make informed choices and that they understand and appreciate the work that farmers and ranchers do for them. I think there's a disconnect between the food that we eat and our awareness of where it comes from. We think it comes from a grocery store. It doesn't. It comes from family farmers across the country working hard every day. So that's first thing. Second thing is it is about rural development, economic development. It is about repopulating rural communities in this country. 90% of farm family income comes from off the farm. They're required to work off the farm in order to keep the farm. So it is important for us to have additional markets that makes it easier for them to improve their bottom line, and at the same time creating jobs. So Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food is focusing on creating wealth in rural communities.
The government pours billions of dollars into subsidizing grains and soybeans, as you know, and so the result is a huge surplus, and some argue that becomes the basis for so many processed foods and additives. Do you think, in a sense, that our system for subsidizing certain foods has made it difficult to innovate?
First of all, farming is probably the most difficult calling an occupation you can have. You have no control over your input costs. You have no control over the market other than to decide when to sell your crop, and you clearly don't have any control over the weather. So if we want to continue to have a ample supply of food at a cost that is relatively inexpensive, you have got to figure out a way to minimize the risk that farmers have. So the programs that we have are designed to provide a cushion, if you will, to minimize risk.
The 2008 Farm Bill, which is now set in stone, lays out almost $35 billion in subsidies for agriculture over the next 5 years. Only a small fraction of money is going to organic farmers and local farmers and small farmers. Do you have the power? Do you think that this department has the power to change the way we eat now and we'll eat in the future?
I don't think this is what the department will do. I think individual consumers, individual families will make those decisions. I think what we do is we provide diversification. We create a better awareness of where food comes from. We create better opportunities for local producers to be supported by local consumers. I think you will see us make healthier, better decisions in the future. And that will, over time, change and I think result in a resurgence, a repopulation of rural areas, and people recognizing that there's real opportunity there.
Tom Vilsack is the Secretary of Agriculture. He's just launched a new program to promote locally produced food. It's called Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food. Secretary Vilsack, thanks for your time.
You bet. Thank you.